Winter relentlessly advanced on Port St. Julian. The days contracted to less than 4 hours of light, and the snow line reached down the mountains, across the fields and swamps, eventually extending to the water's edge. If the crew members and officers ever spent an idle hour at Port St. Julian, there is no record of it. Magellan kept his men too busy and afraid for their lives. Only survival mattered. Amid the intense suffering and hardship, discontent spread. As the prospect of another mutiny loomed, Magellan, along with everyone else in the fleet, was distracted by an unexpected sight, a distant plume of smoke wafting over the landscape. Perhaps they were not alone after all. Pigafetta wrote, "We remained 2 whole months without ever seeing anyone, but one day we saw a giant who was on the shore, quite naked, and who danced, leaped, and sang while he threw sand and dust on his head. Our captain sent one of his men toward him, charging him to leap and sing like the other, to reassure him and show him friendship, which he did." The strange rite recommended by Magellan worked. After watching the European seamen imitate his gestures, the giant appeared peaceful and eager to socialize as the dancing continued. On seeing the giant, every sailor in Port St. Julian thought immediately of the ghastly fate that had befallen the landing party of Juan de Solis 5 years before. Pigafetta wrote, "In time past, these tall men called Canibali in this river aid a Spanish captain named Juan de Solis and 60 men who had gone as we did to discover land, inflating the number of victims in Solis's party, but otherwise invoking that horrible event with clarity." Magellan took the precaution of inviting the giant to meet him in an isolated, protected setting, rather than allowing himself or his men to be lured to an unfamiliar spot where they might be ambushed. The Europeans marveled at the giant's stature. Some crew members reached only the waist of the giant, who was said to be 12 or 13 pomos tall, a pomo being the equivalent of a hand span. By this measurement, he and giants like him stood over 8 feet tall. Pigafetta wrote, "He had a very large face, painted round with red, and his eyes were also painted round with yellow, and in the middle of his cheeks he had 2 hearts painted. He had hardly any hairs on his head, and was painted white." The giant was a member of the tribe known as the Tehuelche Indians, who were numerous throughout the region. In reality, the Tehuelche measured about 6 feet tall. When he was brought to the captain, the giant was clad in the skin of a guanaco, similar to the llama. Magellan invited the giant on board the flagship, where he offered his guest plentiful food and drink, said Pigafetta. Magellan tried to win his guest's confidence with a gift of trinkets, said Pigafetta. 2 bells, a mirror, a comb, and a chaplet of paternosters. This last item was by far the most significant of all the gifts, and no doubt included what is now known as the Lord's Prayer, in Latin, of course. When the feast ended, a guard of 4 armed men escorted him to shore. During the feast, another giant had watched the proceedings from land, and as soon as his tribesmen returned safely, he tore off in the direction of their concealed huts to convey the news. Slowly, the other giants emerged from the trees to reveal themselves to the crew members, who were astounded by the sight and transfixed by the unexpected appearance of giant women. The giant Indians provided a welcome source of companionship and distraction for the crew members from the bleakness of the empty landscape. Everything about their customs and appearance fascinated Pigafetta. "Verily, those giants stand straighter than a horse and are very jealous of their wives," he observed. "They wear a cotton cord around their head, to which they fasten their arrows when they go hunting, and bind their member close to their body by reason of the very great cold." Eventually, Magellan gave the Indians a name, Patagoni, a neologism suggesting the Spanish word patacones, or dogs with great paws, by which he meant to call attention to their big feet, made even larger by the rough-hewn boots they wore. So these were the Big Feet Indians, according to Magellan, who later gave the name to the whole region, known ever since as Patagonia. Relations with the Patagonian giants deteriorated when a European scouting party unearthed a cache of Indian weapons. The discovery suggested that an ambush might be in the making. The crew members sought the safety of the ships. For 2 weeks, no giants were seen, and Magellan decided it was time to change his tactics. On July 28th, 4 Patagonian giants, 2 men and 2 boys, appeared at the water's edge, signaling to the fleet that they wished to come aboard. This was just the opportunity Magellan had been awaiting. A longboat was dispatched to bring the 4 unsuspecting Indians aboard Trinidad. Magellan bestowed presents on his guests, knives, scissors, mirrors, bells, and glass, and while the 4 held them and marveled at them, Pigafetta wrote, the captain sent for large iron fetters, and 2 of the giants were shackled. Instead of resisting, said Pigafetta, the giants took great pleasure in seeing these fetters and did not know where they had to be put. Naively trusting the cunning stranger in their midst, Pigafetta wrote that the giants made a sign with their heads that they were content with this. Magellan then proceeded with his plan. As Pigafetta wrote, forthwith the captain had the fetters put on the feet of both of them, but the captain made signs to them that they should suspect nothing. Nevertheless, perceiving the trick that had been played on them, they began to blow and foam at the mouth like bulls, loudly calling on Setebos, the great devil, to help them. Confusion engulfed both parties. Magellan underwent a sudden change of heart and decided against imprisoning the giants. He ordered a detachment of 9 guards, under the command of Carvalho, Concepcion's pilot, to escort 2 of the giants ashore and to reunite 1 of them with the woman assumed to be his wife. As soon as his feet touched dry land, this giant managed to escape. Carvalho's detachment feared that the tribe would return, seeking revenge. That night, Carvalho, still in charge of the detachment, decided they would sleep ashore. In the morning, the giants' huts were deserted. They had fled into the interior, perhaps for good, perhaps to regroup for a surprise attack. Their intentions became clear when arrows began whizzing from the dark forest. Suddenly, 9 Indian warriors appeared. With fluid movements, they fired off 1 deadly arrow after another. Pigafetta wrote, fighting thus, one of these giants pierced one of our men in the thigh, who died immediately. The suddenness of his death suggests that the arrow carried a poisoned tip. Enraged, the other crew members retaliated with all their might. The weapon's deafening roar scattered the giants, and when quiet returned to Port St. Julian, the detachment sorrowfully buried their fallen colleague. Magellan still held 2 Indians hostage, one aboard Trinidad, the other assigned to San Antonio. And despite his prohibition against passengers, slaves, or stowaways, he intended to present these 2 giants to King Charles. On August 11th, 1520, Magellan carried out the sentence he had proclaimed for his nemesis, Juan de Cartagena, and the priest, Pero Sanchez de la Reina, who had conspired with the Castilian captain. At Magellan's order, both were marooned on a small island in sight of the ships. They had no longboat, no firewood, and scant clothing. Their supplies consisted mainly of bread and wine, enough to last them the summer, perhaps, but they would have to face the next winter in Port St. Julian alone. Magellan finally gave the command to weigh anchor on August 24th. After the harrowing 5-month layover in Port St. Julian, the Armada de Molucca put to sea. The strait still eluded them, but God willing, they would find it and reach the Spice Islands and eventually return to Spain, where they would be rich enough to spend the rest of their lives in retirement. It was a fantastic dream and their only hope of deliverance. As the 4 remaining ships of the Armada sailed into the open waters of the Atlantic, the abandoned conspirators, Cartagena and the priest, watched the spectacle from their island prison. The 2 condemned men kneeled at the water's edge, crying and pleading for mercy as the ships grew smaller and finally vanished over the horizon. From the moment of their departure from Port St. Julian, their journey southward was fraught with more difficulty. After 2 days at sea, as they approached the mouth of the Santa Cruz River, Another storm engulfed them and threatened to drive them all ashore, where they would likely meet the same fate as the unlucky Santiago. Magellan gave the order to enter the broad river, and there, sheltered from the worst of the winds, the fleet rode out the squall. After the storm passed, Magellan, with every fiber of his being, wanted to put to sea and resume the search for the strait. Yet the hazards of exploring the coast in August, as winter relented, remained overwhelming, even to Magellan, who was normally fearless. With the greatest reluctance, he decided to remain here until well into the sub-equatorial spring. Magellan made the most of this enforced layover. For the next 6 weeks, the seamen busied themselves catching fish, drying and salting them, and stocking the ships. They ventured on land only to chop wood and haul it back to the ships. A week later, on October 18, 1520, Magellan decided to risk the open sea again. He supposed, correctly, that the weather was as calm as it ever gets in this region. He was months behind schedule, and he yearned to make up for lost time. Magellan scrutinized every inlet, hoping it might contain a hidden channel leading inland. Finally, he noticed a significant spit of land extending into open waters, a cape. As he approached, he made out a broad sandbank strewn with the skeletons of whales, a suggestion that he had come across a migration route, perhaps leading from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The gray water churned angrily, where competing tides vied with one another, but the opening was wide, a league or more. Vasquito Gallego, an apprentice Portuguese seaman aboard Victoria and the son of her pilot, recalled the gradual realization that the gaping break in the land might be more than a mere bay. He said, as the way became narrower, they thought it was a river. Continuing that way, they found deep salt water and strong currents, appearing to be a strait and the mouth of a big gulf that might be discharging into it. Magellan ordered his ships to sail into the gulf, and when they were well within its embrace, he sought the outlet leading west, just as he prayed it would. Magellan had finally found his strait.